books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we look at the Carnegie Medal for Writing shortlist with Rob Harrell and his book, Popcorn. Plus, we'll find some new books in the RNIB library. Rob Harrell is an author and illustrator, and writes and draws the daily cartoon strip Adam at Home. He wrote about his sight problems in his novel Wink, which we'll talk about later on. But for now, he's on the Carnegie shortlist with his book Popcorn, which is narrated by M. Grosland.
Okay, let's start this awful one for the books day at the beginning. That's where most stories start, I guess. I'm looking in the bathroom mirror, and what I see is decent. A bit gangly and skinny, but not terrible. Inside, I have the regular stew of butterflies and worries, and some irritation that a certain someone's nasty, yellowed nighttime mouth guard was leaning on the bristles of my toothbrush this morning. But I take a couple of deep breaths. I actually feel halfway all right about what the mirror is showing me for once. I clean up okay, as every adult likes to say when a kid puts in the slightest effort. I wash my hands one more time. I'd used a tissue to move the mouthguard, but who knows if that's at all effective. Gross stuff can probably pass through a tissue like air through a screen door. So completely disgusting. I walk out into the kitchen, and my mom is there waiting excitedly. Oh, you look absolutely perfect! She says that. But then, she must see something wrong because she does that disgusting mom move where she licks her thumb and wipes at something beside my mouth. A stray bit of scrambled egg. A toast crumb. Gross! Author's note, it's more than gross. I hate germs. It's a thing. As I wipe any residual spit away, she sits back, grabs my shoulders, and holds me at arm's length. Look at this. Yes, sir, that's my handsome man. Her eyes dart around from my new shirt to my fresh, one-day-old haircut. She smiles. I haven't seen much of that smile lately. I've seen a lot more of the stressed side frown. The Susan Yeager chewing her lip worry face, which typically gives me the Andrew Yeager worried stomach.
Popcorn is a book about this kid, Andrew Yeager, who ends up having just a horrible day on top of the fact that he is plagued constantly with really bad anxiety. He's got a lot going on in his life. His mom is starting a new job that she really needs. His grandmother is suffering from Alzheimer's. So he's got enough on his mind, but he heads off for its school picture day. So his mom wants him to get a good photo. And then just one thing after another at school just keeps going wrong. He gets involved with a bully. There's a science experiment gone wrong. Just one thing after another. Basically, the reason it's called popcorn is he starts to feel like a kernel of popcorn sitting in hot oil that is heating up and getting hotter and hotter. And he starts to wonder what will happen if he pops. His worst nightmare is having a panic attack at school. He's had a couple of those in the past. No spoilers, but the day does not get any better. but he does end up surviving it. And while that all sounds pretty heavy, I will say I found it important to put a lot of humor in the book to help it be a fun read and something that you'd want to read, frankly. So yeah, that's Popcorn in a nutshell.
She pats my shoulders twice. Mika and Jonesy will be here any minute. And I need to get to my big first day. Today is her first day as executive assistant to some big important business guy, and we're both stomach-churningly aware of how much she needs it to go well. My grandmother, G, shuffles into the room in her neon pink housecoat. She's been living with us for the past year and a half or so. She stops in the middle of the kitchen and looks around, confused. Her graying hair looks like she got in a fight with her pillows. My mom turns on her caregiver smile. Hi, Mom. Can I get you anything? She pulls a few cinnamon graham crackers, G's favorite, out of the cupboard. G takes them, scratches her butt, and stands there staring at me like she's not quite sure who I am. Doesn't Andrew look nice, Mom? You always said looking nice for school photos was super important. It's picture day. At the words picture day, my grandmother's face lights up a bit, like the old G I used to know. She holds up a finger and croaks a quiet, oh, yes, yes, yes. Then she hurries, as much as she can, out of the room.
Now, through the book, there are ways that Andrew copes that you almost hide within the text. You don't really realize they're a coping mechanism.
Yeah, you know, I've dealt with anxiety since I was a kid. I had it pretty bad when I was grade school, middle school. So I've been to them some therapy, you know, and I've had therapists who have taught me some coping skills. And so I wanted to get those in there, but I definitely didn't want it to be sort of hitting you over the head with it. You know, here are some coping skills, do these. So it sort of worked into the story, but definitely breathing exercises. And, you know, once things start really going off the rails, there are some other exercises that he uses, like visualization and things like that. So I wanted them in there, but I didn't want it to be, you know, a list of coping skills. So I tried to weave it in naturally.
Now, you're more famous for short-form cartoon strips. What was the jump from short-form cartoon to writing full books?
It's interesting. I always thought of myself as an artist. I started out as an illustrator purely, and then I was a figurative painter for a while. But what I really always wanted to do since I was a kid was write comic strips that would be in the newspaper. And so I finally got that, and I'm still doing it. I still do a daily strip. And I think through writing the strip, I got really more comfortable with writing. So eventually that led to me doing my first book, Monster on the Hill, which was a graphic novel. So, you know, I wrote a 178-page graphic novel story, which is still a lot less writing than a novel. But then I wrote a hybrid book, sort of like Diary of a Wimpy Kid. I wrote a series of those. And I just kept starting to trust myself a little bit more with each book and realizing that I enjoyed the process of writing as much, if not more, than the artwork. So finally, I jumped in with a book called Wink and just decided I'm gonna go for it and write a novel. And it was one of the most rewarding things I've done. So, you know, and that book seemed to help some people from emails that I got, and I was sort of hooked. So then, you know, moved on to popcorn and now I'm figuring out my next steps. But yeah, I sort of snuck in the back door is how I kind of think of it. I started as an artist and somehow became a writer as well.
To combine the two of them, the strip Adam at Home on the day we're recording this is about writer's block. Is that something you suffered from, writer's block?
It is. It's been quite a year. I used to not believe in writer's block because nothing breaks a writer's block like deadlines. So doing the comic strip, I never really had the luxury of you know, having writer's block. But I will say, you know, after Wink has done well and Popcorn has done well, and I really felt the impact that they had with certain people because I've gotten word from them. So I feel a certain amount of responsibility and I can't decide, you know, do I spin off and do something like write a mystery or do something completely different? Or do I write another book sort of along those lines that deals with a heavier issue, but with a light touch? So I've been struggling a bit and I can certainly relate with Adam. And, you know, a lot of my personal life does end up in the strip at times, whether I want it to or not.
Did you actually manage to mind meld with your computer?
I did not mind meld with my computer like Adam did, but I have tried and it has not worked. But I've tried just about everything at this point. But I actually have a couple of ideas that are going pretty well right now. So I think the next book has already been started in my computer.
Now, you said both Wink and Popcorn are based on your own personal experiences, but the character in those two books is much younger than yourself. How do you connect so well with the mind of a middle schooler?
Well, my ex-wife would probably tell you that I'm, you know, still 13 years old at the core. But I think there is something to that, though. I think I've tried to stay young at heart. I keep up with pop culture, and I don't know. I think I just have a young at heart look at life. And so I think I've always remembered, like, some of the most vivid times in my memory are middle school times. It just seems like so much happens in those years where you go from a kid to sort of becoming your own person. So I think maybe that's why there were so many firsts and so many changes going on that I just remember that time really, really vividly. And it's actually pretty easy to put myself back in the halls of my middle school and imagine how things, the situations in my book would have played out in those halls.
In the UK, especially in Scotland, it's just primary school, then secondary school. You go at the run about the age of 11 from being the oldest and the biggest in the school to then becoming the smallest in the school. What sort of ages is middle school?
It's generally, or where I went, it was 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. So that would be 11, 12, and 13. So a 7th, in both books, it's a 7th grader. So that would be a 12-year-old. And, we sort of have a stop in between elementary school, which takes you up to age 10. And then you have 11, 12, and 13 in middle school. And then you go on to high school. So, boy, I can only imagine just switching from one to the other, because I already know when I got to high school that the seniors felt like huge adults, and so middle school was this weird little period in between, and I really do feel like that was a period of great change and a lot of challenges, social challenges, all of that.
That's the most excitement we've seen from G in weeks. You can't take the teacher out of the lady, my mom says. She used to get so worked up over school photos, said, "Those photos are how people will remember you forever." She wasn't completely wrong, either. Somebody I went to school with friend requested me the other day. I had no idea who she was until I got out my yearbook, and boom! Her school photo brought it all back. G walks back into the room, her arms full of middle school yearbooks. They're from my school, but they're ancient. G used to teach social studies at my school way back. She taught there for years. I can't count the number of times we've been stopped by former students at restaurants, thanking her and telling me what a great teacher she was. It's kind of cool, I guess. Although, sometimes, you just want to eat your mac and cheese bites in peace, you know? It's like living with a minor celebrity. G thumps the books down. The stack spills over a bit, but she grabs the top one and opens it with a shaky hand. A number of individual photos, the kind you buy to give to friends, tumble out. Maybe 15 of them, all students. I look up, and G has a huge, proud grin on her face as she pages through to the faculty page. When she finds it, she spins the book around and points at her black and white photo. It's a great picture. She's a lot younger. Her hair is darker, and she's wearing some kind of a vest that looks like it came out of an ancient sitcom. "Pretty good, huh?" I look up, and she's waggling her eyebrows. "Huh?" It's so good to see her happy that my mom and I both laugh. She nods and grabs another yearbook. While she's looking, I pick up a few of the student photos. They all have writing on them. "For Mrs. Hanley, you are the best, Caitlin." "Thank you so much, Mrs. Hanley, Marcus." "Have a great summer, Mrs. H, Jennifer." "I can't thank you enough, Bob." Seems like they liked her a lot, which doesn't surprise me. She was super fun and cool before she started getting sick.
And we'll hear more from Rob Harrell after we visit RNIB Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Etu Kavapu by Mark Radcliffe was given to us by Little Brown.
I used to live in a place called Knutsford, but I've forgotten all about that now because I can't remember things for more than a period of time I have no way of measuring. Rome is a lot busier than that town I was just talking about, whose name escapes me now. There are millions of cars everywhere, and they seem to park so close together that you wonder how people get out of them. Maybe they come through the sunroof or the hatchback. I'm not sure where our car is, but we don't seem to be using it. The last time I saw it was in a cave thing, and someone took the keys off us and drove it away. I wonder if him and her have hit on hard times, and so have had to sell it to that little bloke who lives with all his cars underground. I mean, how many cars does one person need? Anyway, it suits me, because now we just walk everywhere. Apart from waiting for some little humans to turn green, we can go where we want, whenever we want. If only there weren't so many motor vehicles, it would be brilliant. Maybe there should be more of those funny little underground people who keep lots of them, like that bloke who bought ours. That would keep the streets clearer. I think I could have a go at barking most of them out of the way, but it looks like that might be quite a dangerous thing to do, as they're going quite fast. It's a thin line between bravery and stupidity, isn't it? It is, and it's called a lead.
In March 2024, the radio presenter Mark Radcliffe and his wife Bella set off from Cheshire in their VW Beetle convertible for a three-month sojourn in Rome, taking with them their beloved and pampered five-year-old Cavapoo, Arlo. A2 Cavapoo is an account of their time there, told alternatively between Mark and Arlo. Join them as they take in the sights and sniffs of Rome, from Arlo being taunted by his mortal enemies at the city's cat colony, the pros and cons of queuing for pizza, Arlo's fear of water extending to the Trevi Fountain, discovering what exactly the Spanish had to do with those famous steps, and the site where Shakespeare's Caesar uttered the immortal words, "E tu, Brute." Told with humour, affection and insight, this is a travel book like no other, as one man and his dog seek to understand each other in one of the great cities of the world. A must-read for lovers of travel and history, food and drink, art and architecture, and also for those seeking a deep insight into the eccentricities of the canine mind.
Knutsford came back to Arlo in seconds once he'd smelled it all again, but he's right, Rome is full of cars. For obvious reasons, public transport in the centre of the Eternal City is limited. The buses are okay, but every time they try and lay tram tracks or dig to extend the metro, they come across more bits of pillars and piles of stones and have to abandon progress while the archaeologists move in. So there are literally millions of scooters. Many are classic Lambrettas and Vespas, but there are also lots of those that you pick up on an app and then leave strewn haphazardly across the pavement as a trip hazard to pedestrians and their dogs. And there are hundreds of thousands of cars. Like ours, some are stored in subterranean garages with valet service. But most people just have to take their chances at street level. How anyone ever finds a parking space is a mystery, as there don't seem to be any free ever. Roman cars are very different to those you see in the UK. They're generally tiny, the smaller the better for obvious reasons in a crowded city. Most of the makes and models are familiar to the UK motorist, but in contrast to their British counterparts, they're nearly all filthy and bear their dents and scratches proudly like battle scars. Cars here seem to be regarded in the same way as bins. Necessary, but not worth keeping in pristine condition. Or maybe central heating boilers, taken for granted until they break down. I find this refreshing and logical. Have a crappy car, then it doesn't matter if it gets crappier. What a welcome contrast to the British and their worship of ever more ludicrously outsized SUVs kept spotlessly polished. Nor do the Italians, with their noted sense of style, succumb to the ultimate badge of motoring idiocy that is the personalised number plate. You know, guys, I had my name in my clothes at school, but I grew out of it. Think about the kind of person you've become. The Italians do have illustrious history when it comes to automotive design. Companies like Ferrari, Maserati, Bugatti and Lamborghini are all manufacturers of iconic and much coveted classics. You don't really see these on the streets of Rome, as they'd be scraped in seconds by an antediluvian Fiat 126 covered in bird droppings with only one functioning rear light and an offside front wing held on with gaffer tape.
It Too Cavapoo by Mark Radcliffe is narrated by the author and runs for 3 hours and 51 minutes.
Hecate by Nikita Gill was donated by Simon & Schuster.
The day I was born, the universe was on fire. And the reason for this burning was a family at war with itself. They called it the Titanomachy, the war between the old gods and the brand new. Brother against brother, sisters torn apart, fathers fighting their children. And what place does an infant have among such bloodshed, such divine terror? They say on earth that Ica, the god's golden blood, rained from the sky. They say that forests turned from emerald green to gilded with godblood. No one knows how to stop a war when you are immortal. Which is why the universe burned, and as far as the eye can see, there were only embers and ash. Mother was the goddess of oracles and falling stars. On the night I was born, she was all alone. Her cries were heard by no one as she drew me wailing out of her womb, wrapping me in her arms. 1,000 stars fell together from the cosmos. Some called it an omen, others called it a blessing. My mother knew better. Her immortal body, already healed after the birth, she carried me to the balcony of her chambers. As she held me in her arms, we watched a silver shower rain across the midnight sky behind the blazing fire of a 10,000-year-old war. She told me the stars fell because she had granted 1,000 wishes in my name.
Born into a world on fire, godling Hecate has never known safety. After her parents find themselves on the losing side of the war between the ruling Titans and the new Olympian gods, Hecate is taken by her mother, Asteria, to the underworld, where Styx and Hades agree to raise her. Meanwhile, Asteria is pursued across the world by Zeus and Poseidon, and, to escape their clutches, transforms herself into an island in a stormy sea. Orphaned and alone, Hecate grows up among the horrors and beauties of the underworld, desperate to find her divine purpose and a sense of belonging in the land of the dead. When she finally uncovers her powers and ascends to goddess status, she realizes that even the most powerful Olympians are terrified of her. But when a mortal war breaks out again, threatening to destroy everything from Mount Olympus to the underworld itself, the goddess of witchcraft and necromancy is the only one who can bring the deadly conflict to an end.
Father was a god of destruction, ancient and unbroken, stronger than the core of the cosmos, the most legendary of the gods. And this is why the new gods wiped out the stories about him. A story is a powerful thing. It can lead to another war or even resurrect the strongest of all your enemies. He was a god so formidable that the Titans knew no one but he could win them this war. My mother said she never believed any different about my father. She told me he had never lost a game of dice, let alone a battle. I was too young to understand this then. But sometimes we tell ourselves the most beautiful lies just to survive the terrible things that we are living through. Children born in wars are made of a different kind of clay. We become used to the din. We grow used to the collapse of crumbling buildings and fire and develop a compassion for broken things. How can we not when we know nothing else? My mother raised me in a palace where the marble floors cracked under the distant clash of god weapons, adamantine against adamantine. The cloud-colored pillars that held our home up were disintegrating from the roars of the heavens above us. I was told these hallowed halls were once visited by 1,000 giggling nymphs and hundreds of glittering deities, but now it was just a haunting where only my mother and I lived. When the call to war came, the gods, my uncles and cousins left. Eventually, everyone had to pick a side. Most of the Titans chose to support my father. It was, after all, the Titan god-king Kronos who they served. But some Titans betrayed their own. They took up arms against us, choosing to side with Kronos' children, the Olympians, the new gods.
Hecate by Nikita Gill is read by the author, and it runs for 6 hours and 10 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And now I return to my chat with author Rob Harrow from his home in Texas. This time we start talking about his previous book, Wink, which is narrated by Michael Crouch and Mark Thompson.
I'm lying on a steel table, all too aware of the giant ray gun pointed in my direction. It looks like one of those room-sized, 5-ton laser things supervillains use in movies. The kind they threaten to destroy the planet with. What music are you into, Ross? I'm pretty sure the radiation tech is just trying to distract me as he bolts me down. A hard plastic mesh mask over my neck and head holds me still. They molded it to my face yesterday, and the tech struggles to click it onto the table. He scrunches his nose, pushing. Oh, anything. Whatever. I mumble through my teeth. The hardened mask doesn't let my chin move much. The headpiece locks in, and the tech, Frank, gives my shoulder a bump with his fist. Come on, man. If you're gonna lie here for half an hour, you need some tunes. I've got all kinds. Name something you like. There are no wrong answers. I scan my brain. You could... Can you just... KZAQ? Frank stops and doubles over at the waist like he's been gut-punched. He hangs there, talking to the floor. Okay, no wrong answers but that one. He straightens up and winces at me. Seriously? You like that top 40 garbage? It's what my parents have on all the time. So dorky. I try to look away casually, but my head won't budge. Frank stares before letting out an exaggerated sigh. Fine. But tomorrow, tell me what you like, not what Mom and Dad like.
Now, we've mentioned it in passing, but we are the RNIB, the Royal National Institute of Blind People. We can't not talk about Wink. So tell us about Wink.
Wink is based on, it's set in middle school. I was an adult at the time, but I can kind of explain why I did that. But it's based on 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with an extremely rare eye cancer. And it was a really scary time. I went through 8 weeks of radiation treatment, had a surgery. I ended up losing the sight in my right eye. I will say the sight in my left eye is terrible. I have, I think I'm legally blind in that eye. But it almost ended up being quite a bit worse. They were really scared when they found what kind of a tumor it was. I think it was the 25th reported case. It was a carcinoma of the lacrimal gland, a mucoepidermoid carcinoma. It's a mouthful. But so the book is sort of telling my story. But I said it in middle school. I had just gotten done writing a series of books called Life of Zarf, set in middle school. And I really liked writing for that age group. And then I also had one of my friend's daughters was diagnosed with cancer in middle school. So she told me all about her experiences. A lot of hers were social, like friends that stopped hanging out with her, that sort of thing. But then I also had my experience. For example, I had to wear a cowboy hat for 2 years, whether I was inside or outside, I had to be on at all times to keep light off of my skin where I'd been radiated. But so the book Wink is about Ross, and he gets diagnosed, and his 8 weeks of radiation treatments, he gets to, you know, he uses some of the same tools I used to get through it. One is that, you know, I drew my comic strip Big Top at the time. I drew it all the way through, and I think it really helped me to have to think of something funny every day. it helped me put me in a better. So he Ross in the book draws a character called Bat Pig and draws his adventures, and you see those in the book. And then he has a radiation tech that starts getting him into different kinds of music, punk music, which Ross takes to sort of 70s punk. It sort of fits his mood. And then eventually the radiation tech starts teaching him how to play guitar. And then he also just has an amazing support system like I did with my wife and my family and my friends.
He walks over and fiddles with an old-timey boombox on a high wall shelf next to a teetering stack of CDs and cassette tapes. Seriously? There must be a gazillion dollars worth of equipment in here, and they can't afford an MP3 player? I notice a bit of tattoo peeking out from the arm of Frank Scrubs. A lizard tail, maybe? Or a tentacle? Beyonce fills the room, and suddenly Frank is all business. I know we went over this yesterday, but let's review. He wraps his arms around his clipboard and begins, like he's done this 1,000 times. The gurney you're on is going to lift you up and move you into place. The treatment takes 25 minutes or so. Keep your limbs and naughty bits inside the ride at all times. Do not throw things at the radiation techs. Do not feed the radiation techs. Do not waggle your legs around like a synchronized swimmer. Do not pass go. Do not hum the Goo Goo Dolls, as I despise the Goo Goo Dolls. Frank steps aside to let another tech, Callie, I think, reach in and mold some blue clay over the bridge of my nose. She smiles at me and tells me it's to protect my good eye from the beam. Then she pats my chest. I hope I don't look as nervous as I feel, because I feel like a rabbit in a trap. My face is hot. Okay, now for the important part. Frank is back. When I tell you, you're going to stare at the red X above you, the one we made over there by the big zapper yesterday. You'll see it when the machine slides you over. The mask prevents much of a nod, but he seems to catch it. Don't move your eye off of that X, or your eye'll explode into a million pieces like the Death Star. Okay? I let out a little grunt. Frank puts his hand on my arm. I'm kidding, Ross. I mean, kind of. Don't look away from the X. Your eye won't explode, but we're dealing with your vision. Important stuff. So keep your eye on the X, or it could... Just keep your eye on the X, and you'll be fine. Callie steps back in with a U-shaped attachment that looks like part of a kid's car seat. She fits it over my face and helps me slip the molded mouthpiece into my mouth. My teeth lock into it when I bite down, and she snaps the ends of the U to the table. Ka-chunk! The table is attached to a huge mechanical arm, like something out of Star Trek. My nose itches. I couldn't move my head if I had to, and something about that makes me all squirmy inside. I feel like a bug on a dissecting table. Frank and Callie look down at me. You good? Callie squeezes one of my sock-covered toes. Need a blanket? No. I'm good. Okay.
So again, it sounds like a very heavy book, but I made it as funny as I could. And, you know, I think it's a surprising book in that you know, people hear that it's a book about a boy with cancer. It ends up being lighter and funnier than you would expect, which was a trick in and of itself to write that and make it funny. I think people looked at me funny when I first came up with the idea.
Yeah, that must have been quite a tricky pitch meeting.
It was. And then it was tricky to write it. I rewrote and rewrote the book several times because I certainly didn't want anybody to think I was making light of cancer, because it is an incredibly scary thing, and it was a scary time. But so I finally landed on, you know, if the humor came from Ross, it was okay, because, you know, even on the day that you get the worst diagnosis you can imagine, if the doctor gets up and turns around and has a milk dud stuck to their butt, it's still funny. That part of your brain doesn't turn off even though you're in the middle of a horrible situation. So Ross is constantly pointing out the absurdity of things and finding humor in things throughout the book.
Yeah, both Ross and Andrew do use humor to sort of not make light of, but to cope with the situation. Is that important in your writing, that you've got to keep the reader laughing at a serious subject?
Yeah, it is. You know, I think it's also just a part of who I am. I think that's how I was raised. I think that's how I coped growing up, was with humor. And so it comes pretty naturally to me to write that way. But yeah, it was definitely important. And again, I don't want to write a book that's just a slog to get through. For me, even in the most serious of dramatic movies or books, I always appreciate if there's a drop of humor in there. So I tried to put more than a drop. I tried to put in quite a bit of humor. But I think it is an amazing coping skill. I think of the TV show MASH, which is a huge hit over here, which is all about the Korean War. But it was very funny. And it was sort of, I don't know, it really impacted me. And it was about how these people in this awful time, you know, use humor every day. And that's how you get through it.
She shows me a couple more of her photos where she's wearing different but similar vests. Vests must have been her official yearbook photo look. Then she puts her hand on my shoulder and gives it a faint squeeze.
"You look good,"
she smiles, but then straightens her back and pats her chest, looking me in the eye.
"Up straight?"
Then she pulls a second graham cracker out of her nightgown pocket and takes a bite. The woman would eat them all day long if my mom didn't keep them out of sight. She looks down at the pile of yearbooks and back up at me, then turns around and starts shuffling back to her, my old, room. As she goes through the doorway, she lets out a fairly impressive burp. Unfortunately, G isn't all there these days.
That's another clip of M. Grosland reading from Popcorn by my guest, Rob Harrow. Now, Rob, did you have any hand in the casting of M?
I did, which is actually really interesting. Yeah, M's voice just popped out at me as sounding like how Andrew sounded in my head. On both Winky and Popcorn, I guess, you know, I was sent files of a number of people reading parts of the book, and M. Grosland just really jumped out at me. Just was so expressive, and something about the tone of voice was just perfect.
Now, Wink was actually narrated by Michael Crouch and Mark Thompson. Why were there two narrators in that one?
We wanted something different for the Batpig comics. So in that one, it was really fun. They wrote some music, and whenever it switches to one of these Batpig comics that Ross has drawn in the book, in the audiobook, it's done as like a little bit of a radio play about Batpig. So this second guy, he was so good at capturing all the different voices and doing voices of the villain characters, and also this, you know, radio announcer, "The Adventures of Batpig," and he was fantastic. And then Michael Crouch was just, again, he just jumped out at me immediately as the voice of Ross.
Now, some of the Carnegie Shadowers who are accessing Popcorn via Braille or audio will miss a part of the book, but someone with partial sight will know that there are little illustrations on almost every page of Popcorn. Can you describe some of your favourites for us?
Yeah, some of my favourites, you know, he ends up drawing, he has a therapist who suggests that he write or draw in a journal, and she gives him a little journal and says, you know, "I suggest you write or draw about your feelings just to get them on paper." And so he comes up with this little character called Tense Kid, sort of this rough, sketchy, wide-eyed little version of himself, like how he feels when he's anxious, when the anxiety is taking over. But then it eventually evolves into these comics that he draws called The Anxiety Files. There's one where it you know, describes, like, he says funny nicknames for anxiety. You know, one of them is Sizzle Melon, which is, and then it shows a picture of like an egg frying on a kid's head, just because his head's so hot from all the thoughts. And then another is the Noggin Ferrets, which, I don't know, makes me laugh. It's like the 3 a.m., you know, when you're wide awake and the Noggin Ferrets come to chew at your brain and just won't leave you alone, like all the thoughts that won't leave you alone. And then the illustrations get more and more expressive and loose and wild as Andrew sort of loses touch with himself. You know, the day gets bad enough. Again, no spoilers, but he does end up in a bad place. And those illustrations got looser and looser, and just to represent how he was feeling on the inside.
Both with the illustrations in this book and your comic strips, does your eyesight affect your cartooning? Do you have any hints or tips or any special equipment?
Yeah, I do, actually. It affects me in that I've lost my depth perception primarily. It's affected me a little bit. I think I need a new prescription for my left eye because that eye just continues to get worse. But so it affects me a little bit in that I'm always leaning in and getting super close to what I'm drawing. But I work on I switched after I lost the sight. It took about 4 years for the sight to go in my right eye after the radiation. And I used to draw on paper and I used to draw with a brush pen. And it got harder and harder to do that just because of the depth perception. I couldn't tell when the pen was going to hit the paper. And I had a couple of cartoonists I know strongly recommend that I switch to digital. So I bought a Cintiq, it's called. And it is a big monitor that comes with a pen and you can draw right on the screen. And it has pressure sensitivity for the pen. It really, really sped things up for me because I was making so many accidents and using gallons of whiteout before I made the switch. And now I rely on that so heavily. And it's so much easier just to have your finger on the undo button if you make a mark that you don't want to. But it's saved me since I lost that sight.
Are you actually doing them one a day or do you do them in batches?
I do them in batches. Yeah, the strips, I generally do a week at a time. You know, I try to get ahead. It's sort of a constant back and forth. I try to get several weeks ahead on the strip so that I have time to work on whatever book I'm working on. Or, you know, and so I'm constantly going back and forth. I work on the book until I'm just about the deadline is on top of me. And then I start working on the strip. So I kind of bounce back and forth.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the audio version of Popcorn is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of Popcorn?
Yeah, you know, the British cover is a little different than the cover we have here, but they both feature, a drawing of Andrew looking sideways. He's sort of down at the bottom of the cover, and he's looking off to the side and looking nervous. And then a few pieces of popcorn floating around on the cover. And then the name Popcorn is in bright red, just right in the center. It's on a yellow cover. And I should have said that the popcorn, it isn't just that kernel of popcorn in hot oil. There's also sort of a theme in there. His grandmother, who has the Alzheimer's, used to make the world's best popcorn for movie night and all that. She knew how to make it taste just like in the theater. So yeah, popcorn is floating around all over the cover. They sort of embossed the popcorn and all that. I love the way they did the cover.
I grabbed my backpack. I packed it last night. Perfectly, as always. Everything in its proper compartment. I have a system. I put both straps over my shoulders, careful not to wrinkle the new shirt. I can't remember the last time I had a brand new shirt. One that isn't a hand-me-down from my weird cousin in Des Moines. And this sucker has a collar, no less. Wait, let me get a picture. My mom grabs her iPhone, maybe the oldest iPhone still in circulation, and waves her hand for me to get over in front of the plants. I watch her struggling to get the camera app to come up. You sure you don't want me to skip today? I ask. I could ride along, give moral support, maybe a pep talk over lunch? No way, pal. I'm riding solo today, and you are going to go get the best school picture of your life. Your sixth grade photo looked like you were kidnapped or raised by wolves or something. But not this year, my well-put-together friend. She's nervous, which makes me nervous. She needs this job to work out. It could change things, and we really need things to change. And yep, as she aims the phone, she's chewing at that lip again, right on schedule. I feel something in my stomach twist. It's nerves. Anxiety. But it feels like there's a fussy iguana in there. Here's a drawing I made. The Anxiety Files by Andrew Yeager. Cartoon number one. Anxiety 101. Got a fussy iguana in your stomach? Boy, do I. Hey, anxiety! Feel nervous electricity in your shoulders? Yup. Yep, that's it. Swarm of caffeinated eels in your head? Check. Now you're getting it. Want to leave your brain somewhere and go hide? And how? That's the stuff.
Popcorn by Rob Harrell is available in print, audio and ebook commercially. It's also available in audio and braille from RNIB. And Rob, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And in a packed show, we're straight back with Rob Harrell for the Books of His Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I really love the Encyclopedia Brown books. They had all these little mysteries that you could try to solve. But actually, the book that I would name as the one that just lit me up as a kid was The House with the Clock in Its Walls by John Bellaire. And it was a part of a series of books. And it was creepy, a little bit spooky, in just the right amount. And not outright scary, but just had a spooky thing where this kid goes to live with his crazy uncle, and he's odd, and there's odd things going on, and there's a house that's clicking down to doomsday that they can hear in the walls of the house, and they don't know where it is. And yeah, I think as much as any other book, and I keep a copy of that book in my office at all times, just because it holds sort of a magical place in my heart.
Lewis Barneveld fidgeted and wiped his sweaty palms on the seat of the bus that was roaring toward New Zebedee. It was a warm, windy summer evening. Outside, that is. Lewis could see the moonlit trees tossing gently beyond his window, which was sealed shut like all the windows on the bus. He looked down at his purple corduroy trousers, the kind that go whip-whip when you walk. He put his hand up and rubbed it across his hair, which was parted in the middle and slicked down with wild root cream oil. His hand was greasy now, so he wiped it on the seat again. His lips were moving, and he was saying a prayer. He tried to remember more prayers, but he could only come up with questions. It seemed to Lewis that all he could think of these days were questions. Where am I going? Who will I meet? Will I like them? What will happen to me? Lewis Barneveld was 10 years old. Until recently, he had lived with his parents in a small town near Milwaukee. But his father and mother had been killed suddenly one night in a car accident, and now Lewis was on his way to New Zebedee, the county seat of Capharnaum County in the state of Michigan. He was going to live with his Uncle Jonathan, whom he had never met in his life. Of course, Lewis had heard a few things about Uncle Jonathan, like that he smoked and drank and played poker. Lewis had two maiden aunts, and they had warned him about Jonathan. He hoped that the warnings would turn out to be unnecessary. As the bus rounded a curve, Lewis looked at his reflection in the window next to his seat. He saw a moony, fat face with shiny cheeks. The lips on the face were moving. Lewis was saying the prayers again, this time with the wish that they might make Uncle Jonathan like him.
The House with a Clock in Its Walls by Lewis Barneveld is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Christopher Ragland. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, there is. It's not a kid's book, I will say, it, although some people might think so from the cover, but it's Watership Down, I just think, is such an amazing book. I've read it a couple of times, and I could read it again today if I wanted to. It's just, it's got everything. And of course, it is a story about a bunch of rabbits, but it is very much an adult book and features, honestly, some horrific stuff, some war and hunger and real things that real people in the real world face, but told through a group of rabbits. And it's just one of my favorite books of all time.
The primroses were over. Towards the edge of the wood, where the ground became open and sloped down to an old fence and brambly ditch beyond, only a few fading patches of pale yellow still showed among the dog's mercury and oak tree roots. On the other side of the fence, the upper part of the field was full of rabbit holes. In places, the grass was gone altogether, and everywhere there were clusters of dried droppings, through which nothing but the ragwort could grow. 100 yards away, at the bottom of the slope, ran the brook, no more than 3 feet wide, half choked with kingcups, watercress, and blue brook lime. The cart track crossed by a brick culvert and climbed the opposite slope to a 5-barred gate in the thorn hedge. The gate led into the lane. The May sunset was red in clouds, and there was still half an hour to twilight. The dry slope was dotted with rabbits, some nibbling at the thin grass near their holes, others pushing further down to look for dandelions, or perhaps a cowslip that the rest had missed. Here and there one sat upright on an ant heap and looked about, with ears erect and nose in the wind. But a blackbird, singing undisturbed on the outskirts of the wood, showed that there was nothing alarming there. And in the other direction, along the brook, all was plain to be seen, empty and quiet. The warren was at peace. At the top of the bank, close to the wild cherry where the blackbird sang, was a little group of holes almost hidden by brambles. In the green half-light, at the mouth of one of these holes, 2 rabbits were sitting together side by side. At length, the larger of the 2 came out, slipped along the bank under cover of the brambles, and so down into the ditch, and up into the field. A few moments later, the other followed. The first rabbit stopped in a sunny patch and scratched his ear with rapid movements of his hind leg. Although he was a yearling, and still below full weight, he had not the harassed look of most outskirters, that is, the rank and file of ordinary rabbits in their first year, who, lacking either aristocratic parentage or unusual size and strength, get sat on by their elders, and live, as best they can, often in the open, on the edge of the warren. He looked as though he knew how to take care of himself. There was a shrewd, buoyant air about him as he sat up, looked round, and rubbed both front paws over his nose. As soon as he was satisfied that all was well, he laid back his ears and set to work on the grass.
Watership Down by Richard Adams is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Robin Holmes, and it's also available in Braille. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very well-known book, but I finally got around to reading East of Eden by Steinbeck, and I just absolutely adore that book. I think it's just got everything. It's, you know, this multi-generational story about the Trask family, and it sort of took my breath away. I read it last summer. I was on a vacation up in Michigan, and I had the time, and I sat on a front porch and read that book, and it just knocked my socks off. And, you know, so it's a classic for good reason, I would say, and very, very enjoyable. Just a fantastic read.
The Salinas Valley is in Northern California. It is a long, narrow swale between 2 ranges of mountains, and the Salinas River winds and twists up the center until it falls at last into Monterey Bay. I remember my childhood names for grasses and secret flowers. I remember where a toad may live, and what time the birds awaken in the summer, and what trees and seasons smelled like, how people looked and walked and smelled even. The memory of odors is very rich. I remember that the Gabilan Mountains to the east of the valley were light, gay mountains full of sun and loveliness, and a kind of invitation so that you wanted to climb into their warm foothills almost as you would climb into the lap of a beloved mother. They were beckoning mountains with a brown grass love. The Santa Lucias stood up against the sky to the west and kept the valley from the open sea, and they were dark and brooding, unfriendly and dangerous. I always found in myself a dread of west and a love of east. Where I ever got such an idea, I cannot say, unless it could be that the morning came over the peaks of the Gabilans, and the night drifted back from the ridges of the Santa Lucias. It may be that the birth and death of the day had some part in my feeling about the two ranges of mountains. From both sides of the valley, little streams slipped out of the hill canyons and fell into the bed of the Salinas River. In the winter of wet years, the streams ran full freshet, and they swelled the river until sometimes it raged and boiled, bank full, and then it was a destroyer. The river tore the edges of the farmlands and washed whole acres down. It toppled barns and houses into itself to go floating and bobbing away. It trapped cows and pigs and sheep and drowned them in its muddy brown water and carried them to the sea. Then, when the late spring came, the river drew in from its edges and the sandbanks appeared. And in the summer, the river didn't run at all above ground. Some pools would be left in the deep swirl places under a high bank. The tules and grasses grew back, and willows straightened up with the flood debris in their upper branches. The Salinas was only a part-time river. The summer sun drove it underground. It was not a fine river at all, but it was the only one we had, and so we boasted about it, how dangerous it was in a wet winter, and how dry it was in a dry summer. You can boast about anything if it's all you have. Maybe the less you have, the more you are required to boast.
There are a few versions of East of Eden by John Steinbeck, available from RNIB Talking Books. That one is read by Liza Ross and Adam Henderson. It's also available in Braille. And once again, Rob, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much. This has been really fun.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.